LibroFM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. Choose from more than 150,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With LibroFM, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know what one we're talking about, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community.
If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. Listen while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free LibroFM app.
If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from the people who know audiobooks best, local booksellers.
Listeners of the Bookstore Podcast can get a 2-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month.
Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter bookstore at checkout. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores.
Welcome to the bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. This week, we are going to be talking about a couple of interesting news items, opinion pieces. We're going to have opinions on things that we just find, interesting. So they're semi-related to book news, mostly just related to one of them at least being a bad internet take. So
yeah,
we're here to dismantle it. Shall we get started?
Yeah. So some of you may have read an article called Overdue, Throwing the Book at Libraries by Kenneth White.
It was from the Globe and Mail.
Yes, yeah. And he is Canadian. I don't know if that matters, but this is from a Canadian perspective. I guess I have to say that. I don't know.
Although he relies heavily on, like, American numbers for things.
Yeah.
So I think it's fair that we can, have opinions on this.
So the gist of the article is that libraries are taking market share from independent bookstores.
And publishers.
And authors.
Specifically, yeah.
Because libraries exist, people aren't buying books. Like, if libraries weren't around to borrow books, people would just be buying books, which would result in more sales for indie bookstores and authors, so that authors wouldn't be so poor, as he puts it, that authors are poor, and indie bookstores would not be closing.
Right. Yes.
So what did you think?
Well, first of all, I want to say that Kenneth White, the author of this opinion piece, is also the publisher of Sutherland House Books. And he has written a book before. So he's got, like, a lot of skin in this game, really. Like, he is a publisher. So he stands to make money from publishing and selling books, which I think is going to explain a lot of his opinions on this. So, first of all, I think this is really a weird and a dumb thing to get mad about, because it seems to me that he's mad at a system that allows people who do work to be poor, which is a problem with capitalism, not a problem with social programs that exist to help the poor and the public in general. So that is my overarching view on all of this. And then in other ways, I think that his logic is incredibly flawed. He talks a lot about, he has, like, a lot of numbers, and I don't 100% understand where he gets them from, but he repeats over and over and over again that 4 out of every 5 books that's read is borrowed from a library. And the thing about that is that the only examples he uses for books, like the only books that he name drops, are by Stephen King and then 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. So he says something like, the library will buy 60 copies of Stephen King's new novel, right? And I think the fault in his logic that I am finding is that he somehow thinks that, like, if people can't just get those books from the library, which, I mean, he's basically saying that people people just want to read Stephen King, that they will buy the books, which again would then just be Stephen King's books. They wouldn't be Kenneth White's book about Hoover called Hoover, An Extraordinary Life in Extraordinary Times. So I think there's a flawed logic there. Like, the thing is like, Stephen King is already a millionaire. E.L. James is already a millionaire. If those are the books that people are lending from libraries, those people are already millionaires. We're not talking about, like, the people who self-publish their books. Those still are going to have a harder time finding readers than Stephen King, yes, and E.L. James. I think that's, yeah.
Yeah, like whatever episode it was that we had the interview with the librarian, libraries do rebuy books. Probably, yes, they have to buy a new copy of The Shining every 2 years.
Right.
If I bought The Shining, I would purchase it one time.
Yes.
And I would never have to purchase it again because, right, I don't have 10 people, you know, every month, or maybe that's an exaggeration, 10 people every 6 months reading that book.
Right. And also, I mean, does he not think that if somebody buys a book that only that one person will ever read it? Because I lend out books. I know my mom's friends pass books around to each other so that they're not buying all that many books between them. So, like, yeah, there's a lot of, like, flawed logic in this, I think, aside from the fact that he's just kind of shitty about, like, the purpose of libraries to begin with, in which he seems to think that librarians exist just to knock books out of people's hands at bookstores and tell them that they can get free ones from the library instead.
One thing that I thought was really idiotic of him as well is he keeps bringing up, like, that libraries sort of market themselves as saying this is how much money you've saved.
Right.
So he is taking that as, like, a fact that the libraries did peer-reviewed studies that showed this is the amount of money, but that's not why libraries market like that. You know,
yes,
I could add up all the books that I check out from the library and add them up for how much they are, a lot of hardcovers, because I don't buy hardcovers, and I would have saved a ton of money. Like, you could put, like, oh, how many hundreds of dollars that I saved a year in going to the library. But the fact is that if I couldn't get it from the library, I would not purchase it.
Right.
And
yeah,
what he takes this as, like, libraries are being completely serious. Like, this is, like, an actual study we did. We know this for a fact. You would save this much money. But what they're really doing is just saying, this is what your taxes are going towards. I don't know how much I actually pay in property taxes that goes to the library, but it is a minuscule amount.
Right.
So what libraries are saying, if they market like that, is just like, look at how much you pay for
this,
the library.
This is the value for your taxes. Yes.
This is the how much value you get. And he doesn't see it that way, which just feels like really dumb to me.
I know what I was going to say earlier, too, is that he completely misrepresents the way that digital lending works from libraries. He says that digital books are able to be lent out, like, forever and ever and don't degrade. And that's not how the licensing works. Libraries pay a lot of money, as you covered in the Librarian Interview episode. They pay a lot of money for the licensing for digital ebooks. And so, like, it's not,
and,
like,
it expires. The digital license also expires. So again, they could be paying $60 for one book every few years.
Right. And I mean, also, libraries will buy multiple copies of books that are popular. So it's still, like, acting within the way that the market works. Like, of course, maybe Hoover, An Extraordinary Life in Extraordinary Times wouldn't be getting checked out as frequently as 50 Shades of Grey, but that's probably true for the way that the sales are working for it.
And I mean, honestly, that's how we kind of want libraries to work. Like, yes, I get very excited when my library gets in maybe a not so popular book that I want to read, but they should be stocking what people are reading. So yes, if a library has a ton of Stephen King, that's because people are reading Stephen King. And if they buy one copy of Hoover, An Extraordinary Life, and nobody checks it out, and so they get rid of it, that's just how it's supposed to work.
Yeah. He does, if you're like at home wondering, like, does this guy not know that librarians do other things than try to get people to read his book for free? he does acknowledge the fact that librarians offer free workshops on how to use a computer, or, you know, help people set up email accounts if they don't have access to the internet at home, or they teach workshops on how to do how to write a resume, or a number of public programming situations, et cetera, et cetera, all the way on down to just like making sure that if a person who is not homed needs a warm place to sit in the middle of winter, they can do that at the library. But he still seems to think that like that is only possible because librarians are hawking his books for free, I think.
Yes.
Which is just, it is such like a nihilistic view. Maybe not nihilistic isn't the right word, but it's such a like pure capitalist view of the way that things should, he thinks the way that things should work, that I just can't like even engage with it, because he doesn't necessarily seem to think that like, you know, libraries offering public services is worthwhile if it comes at the expense of some books being borrowed. There's another thing he does talk about. I want to find it. I'll read the exact quote. The numbers are worse in Canada. Ontario and BC public libraries, serving half of Canada's population, circulated 166 million items in 2018. And this is parenthetical. Books, DVDs, musical instruments, and swear to God, power tools. End parentheses. He's mad that the library also lends out power tools, I guess. Which is like one of my favorite things that libraries do is like offer things that people may not have access to for free so that they don't have to spend $70 on a drill that they're going to use once in their life. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, he seems to think that like where am I going? I lost my train of thought twice now. There's just so much to be upset about with this guy. He seems to think that only authors are poor. Like, he talks about how little authors paid.
Hold on. Let me get the quote.
Talked about that before, and again, like you said, that's a problem with capitalism, not a problem with libraries. But he also doesn't seem to understand that other people don't have money. Like, he wants adults to pay. His idea is like to pay for like a subscription fee to the library. I don't know how to tell people that there are people who cannot afford the $12.99 Netflix fee a month.
Yes.
For some reason, and maybe this is because he's Canadian, I don't know, but I guarantee you that there are many, 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 many households in the U.S. who cannot afford that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just like $13 is not just like, oh, whatever, I won't even notice it in my bank account to people. That is a lot of money to people. And it
you're
just
already
like,
paying a subscription to use the library. Yeah. It's called your taxes. Yeah. That's what it's.
I just think. I like when I was a kid, we didn't really buy, like, I would get a couple books for like Christmas and birthdays, but we didn't really buy books regularly, always use the library. So I would not have read even like a quarter of what I have read in my life if it wasn't for the library growing up.
I was saying that to Josh, too. I think, like, let's assume that this is a number pulled completely out of nowhere, because, like, people don't have just unlimited money to buy books. So let's assume, like, your budget allows you to buy one book a month, right? That means you get to read 12 books a year then. Like, that's it. It's still, it's not like people have unlimited cash to go buy every book, and that's somehow going to haul authors out of poverty. So his assumption that people will be buying his book specifically, which, I mean, it's not his assumption, I am projecting that, but like, it seems to come from a position of like, well, people aren't buying my books, so that's the problem. But here's the quote that I think is like rather telling. Maybe you're unsympathetic to the plight of independent booksellers, or prefer to blame Indigo's Mrs. Reisman, and I think Indigo is a Canadian book chain, and Amazon's Jeff Bezos for their decline. And I am, by the way. It's funny that you're going after librarians who make $52,000 a year U.S. on average, which is quoted in here as if it's like outrageous. It's not. And and you're not going after Jeff Bezos, who, like, over the course of quarantine added, like, what, $41 billion to his net worth? Anyway, I digress. The rest of the quote is this. Let's approach it another way. Imagine yourself an author. Or, rather, imagine yourself poor. Yes. We can't imagine ourselves poor. And so he goes on to talk about, like, how, according to the U.S. Authors Guild, the median income for its members, including full-time, part-time, traditionally published and self-published authors, was $6,080 U.S. in 2018, down from $10,500 in 2009, which, yeah, that's not much money, but he is considering full-time, part-time, traditionally published and self-published authors. Like, that could include my mom's friend who wrote a book about her childhood growing up in a small town that was basically only marketed to, like, the 17 families that lived in that small town.
That's like, so cute.
This is, like, we're not talking about necessarily people who are devoting 100% of their life to just writing. I don't think this is even a fair argument to make. Yeah.
Yeah, no. And I also think that historically, authors aren't all millionaires. It's very, right. very small percentage who live off of just writing. A lot of them have other jobs, you know, and whether that's good or bad, that's a discussion for something else, like not what he's saying. He's just like,
right.
no, all of these authors deserve to make more money. It's also interesting that he brings up, it's not Amazon that's making these indie bookstores go out of business. It's libraries, because libraries and bookstores have coexisted for hundreds of years.
Yes.
But Amazon has only been around for the last, I don't know,
20,
30 years. I have no
30
idea.
30 years, maybe? Yeah. I think it started mid-90s, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's got to be definitely the libraries, not this, in the broad scheme of things, like brand new online bookseller. Can't be that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it also ignores the fact that since we were speaking historically about, like, what authors make in terms of money, which, again, isn't a lot. If we're talking truly historically, the people who wrote books were generationally wealthy. So, yes. like, that yeah. what they tended to come from a position of relative privilege, as much as we like to think that it was starving artists toiling away to then somehow make millions or something. It's not exactly how it works. But yeah, I mean, it's a bad opinion, and it got to Twitter, and there was one guy who has now deleted all of his tweets. I'm not going to call him out specifically, but, like, who was going very hard defending this and saying that librarians were exploiting authors' works. And it's a wrong opinion. It's wrong. I'm here to say it's wrong.
Can you just say what kind of books he writes?
Technically, he is traditionally published, like in a traditional publishing house, but I think it was young adult books about, like, ancient Greece or something. And one of them was published in 2005 and had three unverified reviews on Amazon. So I'm not saying that the libraries weren't eating up all of his, sales, but I am saying that maybe he had other issues in selling his books. But yeah, I mean, I am being, like, incredibly catty, but I think this is just, like, this is such a misplaced argument to make that it's utterly baffling and, like, monumentally stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to read the article. It's so bad.
Yeah.
It makes me so mad. Anyway.
In some ways it makes it me feel like I'm maybe, like, being mean specifically to authors. And I don't want it to come across that way. Obviously, like, our podcast exists because people write books and we love the people who write them, and we're so happy for them because it makes our lives much better. But, like, we also can do this podcast because we get some of our books from the library, a number of them from the library, probably half of them at least. And, you know, like, him coming down on librarians and how much librarians make when you need to go to school and get a master's mm-hmm. degree most of the time to become a librarian, and comparing that to what self-published authors make, which, again, not trying to shit on self-published authors, but you don't need any training to become one. So, like, the startup costs there are different. Right. So, yeah, it's just, I think it's a completely disingenuous kind of argument to make. And if we see the end of libraries, I think you can also say that we're going to be seeing, like, the end of democracy. I am that much of a doomsdayer about this, so.
Yeah, and that's kind of why this makes me so mad, is because I do know in some rural counties, they have done away with public library funding.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's hard on people. They do have some sort of, like, subscription service, but they can't do any library loaning because they're their own separate thing. So you can't get something from a different library because it's not part of your circulation.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, it just really restricts people. I don't know. It's, I don't know. Literacy will go down if we get rid of libraries, I guess.
Yeah.
There's nothing good that can come out of it.
No. If you're a writer specifically, or a publisher, or work for a bookstore or any of those things, and have opinions on the purpose of libraries in our society, feel free to let us know. We're interested because, I mean, we both worked at a bookstore, but maybe opinions have changed. Maybe you do see the library as your, you know, absolute competition, though. I have heard from some of you before, and I have a feeling that you don't feel that way.
I mean, I'll say that I heard many times, oh, I'll just go buy it from Amazon, but I never heard, oh, I'm just going to go borrow this from the library.
That's true. You're right. I heard 1,000 times more often that people were mad at me because I couldn't give them a book for half of its list price because Amazon had it for that price. So yeah, I think that's anecdotal evidence, but it speaks to my experience. Anyway, thank you, Kenneth White, for the fodder. Moving on, we have another interesting topic. This comes from the UK. Basically, the article that we got this from is, it's from The Guardian. It's by Alison Flood, and it is called "Author Loses Spot in Top 10 After Buying 400 Copies of His Own Book." Mark Dawson is the author of a new thriller called The Cleaner, and I believe it was self-published. After finding out that he was, like, number 13 on the UK's bestseller list, he bought an order of 400 hardcover copies of his book at a children's bookstore in Salisbury, and at the cost of £3,600. And he said he wanted to do it after he saw that he was in the 13th spot on Nielsen's midweek chart. And so he contacted fans of his from overseas in the US and Australia, etc., to see if they would purchase copies from him. And so he went and bought the books, and he talked about this on a podcast called The Self-Publishing Show. He was then investigated by Nielsen and removed from the top 10 list because those 400 copies bumped him from, like, number 13 to number 8 on the list.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, right? It's just, like, the difference was 400 copies. I think that's partially why I find this, like, so interesting. Of course, the UK is a smaller country than the US, so I don't know what the numbers are, but, like, the numbers on bestsellers lists are so obscured. Like, you have no idea what it takes. Like, you could, I think we've talked about this on a Scandals episode before, but, like, you could tell me that you need to sell 15,000 copies or 200,000 copies, and I'd probably believe you because I don't know what it takes.
Yeah. I also find this really interesting because I have heard of two other self-published authors based in the UK, sort of the kind of self-publishing where you, like, crowdfund the money and then a publisher, like, binds it and puts it out for you kind of thing, which I consider self-publishing, to be honest, but which is fine. But I've heard of two other authors who will buy books for their fans in the US. It must be because either the publisher doesn't send them to the US, or maybe postage is cheaper if they just send it personally. Which does make sense to me. That makes perfect sense. You know, if it can be hard to find a self-published book in print anyways, and that makes sense. But what he did, I didn't realize this the first time I read the article, is he did do it specifically to get into the top 10.
Right. And I think it's funny because I've read two articles about this now, and he says that he didn't do it specifically to get on the top 10, but then he also says that he did in other ones. Because he's like, if I thought that it was wrong, I wouldn't have went and talked about it on a podcast. And if I thought it was that important, I would have bought 10,000 copies to get me to number one instead of just number eight or whatever. But yeah, so I think like a little bit of it is like he's not being like 100% truthful about his mm-hmm. actions and choices. But at the same time, I agree with you. I don't know that it's necessarily like the most wrong thing you can do. They were going to go to real customers, as it right. were. But I don't know. It's interesting. One of the articles talks about that book that we spoke about on one of our Scandals episodes, The Handbook for Mortals by mm-hmm. Lainey Selman or whatever her name was, and then who had like specifically bought like a ton of copies of books from one store and then launched to the top of the New York Times bestsellers list, and she got caught and was removed from the chart. And it also talks about Donald Trump Jr., whose book Triggered made it to the number one spot because the RNC bought almost like $100,000 worth of copies before it was released. And then the New York Times didn't remove him from the chart, but did publish it with a dagger next to the title, which is their way of saying that like the many of the purchases were in bulk. It's interesting because this article that I'm reading or read has statistics that says like one 2004 study found that making the New York Times bestseller list saw a debut author's sales increase by 57%, while the average for all authors was about a 13% boost in sales, which, I mean, that can make a pretty significant difference. Obviously, 57% is a huge difference, but 13 could be a significant difference, too, depending on, again, how many it actually takes to get on the bestsellers list, which is a little bit of a mystery.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too to me because I don't really pay any attention to bestseller lists at all.
Yeah.
For better or for worse, I don't know. It's just not something I'm interested in. But it obviously does result in more sales. It's just when you are buying in bulk like Dawson did and like the RNC did, it's like you don't really know if people actually then purchased that book.
Right. Right. Because I think, like, you know, it's happened before, and I don't mean to target Republicans specifically, but I remember having heard about it with, like, political candidates buying in bulk and then giving those things as gifts to, like, fundraising and whatever. So, like, yeah, you don't know if it's just a kind of marketing cost that they're taking on themselves or if somebody is actually paying for them.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I would love to know what the numbers look like. I could probably Google it, but I feel like I've done it before and it wasn't very fruitful.
Well, because I feel like I only hear about the numbers when it's like a crazy amount, like 150,000 copies of whatever latest political drama book just came out, Woodard or whatever, you know? So you only hear the biggest numbers and it's always like record-breaking, new record-breaking hardcover, and it's like, okay, so what was the record that was broken?
Right.
And then what is a normal? Like, what would be a normal number one?
So I did Google it real quick. This article from entrepreneur.com from 2016 says that 5,000 copies during any 1 week period is the minimum, which is not a huge number, especially when you compare it to what was it, the Mary Trump book that we just talked about last week or whenever it was that sold like, what was it, 150,000 copies or something the first week. So like there's a huge difference. So yeah, it's kind of
5,000 is like seems so little.
I know,
compared to that.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I wonder what it's, how the difference is with the UK too, if it's less or if it's more.
Yeah, nobody knows. It's a marketing secret. Anyway, interesting topics generate some probably lively debates, one livelier than the other, I suppose. But you can decide if you think that Dawson is a fraud or whatever, if you want to on your own time. I think that's all.
You can send us your pick for who's going to win the Booker. prize.
Oh, yeah. The Booker did get announced.
Actually, just let us know if you think it's not going to be Hillary Mantel.
Oh, yeah. Good luck to everybody else. They'll probably give it to Margaret Atwood again for no reason.
It'll be a dual prize again.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening to The Bookstore, or should we call ourselves The Library now? I'm not really sure.
If you would like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore or rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
You can find all of the ways you can contact us at thebookstorepodcast.com. We've got our email, social media, and our phone line all up there.
Our next book discussion will be The Old Drift by Namwali Sirpel. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becky Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday. Bye. Bye.
Oh, you know what would be really interesting? I wonder how libraries are in other countries. Like, I would say non-English speaking countries, because I've been to, like, you know, the UK and Australia. And so I know what their libraries are like, but I have no idea if it's different, if it's the same. I don't know.